Well, let's open in prayer. Could y'all get those doors in the back? And we'll open in prayer and then get going, and I'll introduce our guests as well. Father, thank you so much for the opportunity to gather together in your Son's name. And what an awesome thing. And God, we want this church, we want the church to be a place where people can experience very real, very practical, very seriously abundant ways to live out the life that you have offered us through your Son. And Lord, I pray that you would guide our evening tonight, that it would be helpful to people, that people would once again, we would be able to see the church as a resource for how to live out life, the life you've called us to as parents, as spouses, as ministers, as leaders, as ambassadors for your kingdom. Lord, I pray you would guide us. We ask that your will would be done tonight. It would be encouraging to us and glorifying to you everything we say and do. And we ask this in your Son's name. Amen. All right. So I'm going to start. I'll introduce these two characters behind me are two of the therapists from Aletheia Family Counseling Center. If you don't know, in addition to being the campus pastor here, I'm the owner-operator of Aletheia Family Counseling Center. We have 10 therapists at our center. We do pretty much everything. You pretty much ask it from a therapeutic perspective, and we've got somebody who's good at it. And so all kinds of hours, all types of options. And so when there's a family team, there's a work team that's a family work team that I met with and said, I'm always very skittish to bring in, quote, my counselors to do a seminar. I'm very hesitant to host a seminar here and like to do that and like charge for a seminar, which we do sometimes. And it was really funny. So I brought that to the CMT and they said, yeah, because it makes a ton more sense for you to host it at another church. Right. That makes sense. And so we'll all feel better if we're like, oh, great, our campus pastor is hosting the parenting seminar at a different church. That says what we want to say. And so that was good. And then when we brought it to the deacons, I'm telling you guys, I'm nervous about this kind of stuff. So I brought it to the deacons and said, hey, guys, guys and ladies, is it okay if, what do y'all think about this? And literally I said, what do y'all think about this? And people started raising their hands saying, when is it going to be? How do I get people to sign up? And I'm like, no, I'm just asking for permission. Like, is it okay? Is it going to offend anybody if somebody pays to go to a parenting seminar and they're like, uh-huh, good, yeah, no, that's no problem. So when is it going to be? And I've got friends who need to be there, and I'm friends, you know, that works. I've got friends who need to be there. And so anyway, we wanted to do something now just as quickly as possible, and then our counseling center will probably host another thing in May here, another parenting type thing that'll be more general. I want to open with, I'm going to talk for just 10 or 15 minutes, and then I'm going to open it up to questions. For any questions, any parenting questions at all, and the three of us will cover that. So these are both licensed professional counselors. Allison Cooper, who actually goes here, is a member here. And so you can find her at any point. And she is awesome and excellent, especially an expert on anxiety issues. But honestly, she can do anything. And Josh Berger, who we tolerate as well around the office every once in a while. I say that because Josh's counseling hours were full before he was done being an intern, and no one ever does that. Like, that broke some kind of record in the counseling world, and Josh is excellent, especially working with teenagers and young people, and anyway, I'm very proud, incredibly proud to have both of them on that team. I can't even tell you, but so here's the deal. Here's the basic philosophy that I like to teach about parenting. This is just a base philosophy. It comes from Deuteronomy chapter 6. The idea in Deuteronomy chapter 6 is that it is the parent's job to raise and parent and guide and educate and spiritually lead their kids. That is the primary job of the parents. It is not primarily the job of the church or of the children's minister or of the youth pastor. It falls squarely on the shoulder of the parents. And so what that means is what I want our church to become is an equipping church that equips you on how to lead your family. In Deuteronomy 6, it tells us that the basic truths that God, who God is, that he is real, that he is one, that we should love him with everything we've got. These are the basic teachings that we've got to make sure we are teaching our kids. It's great when the professional Christian does it. That's fine. But that's easily dismissed, as many of you know. What matters is whether mom and dad are doing it. Are mom and dad living this? And this is an important part of it. Are mom and dad not just saying it, but are they living it? Is it being lived out for the kids to see? Does the marriage indicate that what they're teaching is true? Does the way they engage? Because fundamentally, being a dad is about creating a picture of what God's paternal traits look like. That's what it means to be a father. Fathers are who are supposed to live out the paternal traits of God. And to the degree we do a good job of that, our kids will intuitively understand the paternal traits of God. Being a mom is about reflecting the maternal traits of God. That's the main job. To the degree you do that well, you're a good mom. To the degree you do that poorly, you're a poor mom. Just like the same thing with dad. To the degree we live that out. This is vital. And so understand, part of why this is so important is that our children are hardwired. Many of you already know this. To intuitively see God the way they see us. This is going to happen whether you like it or not. And so when you have a parent who is overly harsh or critical or emotionally distant, that's what they're going to intuitively think God is like. If they have a parent who is overly passive or is always reacting and not being intentional or is always protecting them from every little thing, kind of hovering, that's what they're going to think God is like. Both of those, by the way, are wrong. So I think it's vital that as we engage in this conversation, that we are recognizing how we do this has to be reflected in who God is and how we want our children to intuitively understand God. Many of you have such bad examples of parents that you know how hard it is that you have to decide to think of God differently than you think of your parents. That's a choice. It is that I don't want my children to have to make that choice much. I want my children's difference between me and God to be a small difference as far as character. Like that they would not have to go like, wow, some of you probably had to start over here and go like, okay, this is my dad and this is God. And we don't want to create that situation for our children. That's really a hard transition to make, as some of you know perfectly well how hard that is. So one of the areas of parenting that I feel like most especially Christian parents stink at is giving freedom. So this is going to be this is the next step. And when I'm done with this part, I'm literally going to open up to questions for us to answer. And you don't have to follow along with what I've said at all. But this is one of the areas that I think is important for Christian parents, is that we are fighting for our kids' freedom. So I don't have any left. I literally am down to one coin. So the whole analogy doesn't work when I only have one coin. If any of you are going to Vegas anytime soon, incidentally, I need $1 coins from the Excalibur Hotel. So Buy me like 20 of those, if you don't mind, and bring them to me. I'll pay you back. But they're the best. They're like nice and heavy. And I know it's a bunch of Baptists. You may not, none of you are going to admit like, well, I'm going next week. But I mean, like, if you go, I won't tell it was you. Those are the best. So you go buy the Excalibur for me and pick up $21 coins or a bunch more. Buy me 100 of them and I'll pay you back. That way the other therapist can have those too. Don't gamble with them because then you'll lose them and I won't get them. Like I just buy them for me. Don't put them on red or anything. What was I saying? So here's the idea, guys, is too often we forget that when God gave us these kids, that one day they were going to leave. And so everything about the way we parent needs to be based on that understanding. There's going to come a day when they need to not be dependent on us, when they need to not have to rely on us to make decisions. When they know how to make good decisions, when they need to know how to handle hard situations and that kind of stuff. So what we want to be doing, too often, secular parents, what they do, so these coins represent freedom and responsibility. And too often what happens is secular parents give away these coins too quickly. That's why when you go to, I was going to say a Harry Potter movie, but again, we're all Christians, so none of us went to those. Lord of the Rings movie, totally. Narnia movie. There you go. Those were allowed to go to those. To a Narnia, I'm totally kidding about all of that, by the way. But so you go to a Narnia movie that's very scary and you see, 3-year-olds in the room and you're like, wow, you realize that this is going to be traumatizing for your child, right? They're like, oh, they don't pay any attention, or oh, but they love these movies and they like Stephen King movies too. And so you go like, this is a bad idea. But they're giving that decision to their kids too young. Kids don't know, they don't understand the concept. Just like I think it's starting to do it. Do we have a backup cord? John was checking. Anyway, I started noticing the other day it was popping. That's always a bad sign. Like, one of these days soon, it's going to start exploding on us. Where was I? Narnia. So the movies, and so you say, so too often the secular parents give away too many coins too quickly, which is not okay. That's traumatizing and can be scarring for kids. Most of us have heard stories, if it's not in our family, of the dad who's like, you know, I taught my children about sex by giving them a Playboy magazine type of thing. This is obviously not healthy, and yeah, it's going to get worse. Okay, I'm going to talk on this while he fixes that. He's going to do surgery down here. So again, where was I? I was past Narnia this time. Okay, so Christian parents too often hoard the coins too long. We don't give away the coins as quickly as we should. And what ends up happening is, this is part of why we lose so many kids in college, is that what happens is at about age 18, suddenly, so if there's 20 coins at birth, suddenly 14 coins get dumped on this kid. And here's why. It's easier to control kids than to give them freedom. It's easier to do, behavioral modification is easier than internal change. And so what we want to be able to do, what we want to be doing is intentionally figuring out what freedoms our children can survive, even if they fail. So that we say, yes, you can make this decision. Even if you fail, you're going to be okay. It may be hard. It may be painful. It may hurt. But we're going to let you face that. So the analogy that I use is like the kid going who wants to go to the zoo. You're going to the zoo here in Tyler in November, and you say, hey, go grab a coat, and your 10-year-old son says, I don't want to wear a coat. Well, okay, so is the child going to survive being without a coat? Sure. Now, as an adult, do you know they're going to be cold? Yes. Are they going to be pretty miserable some of the time? Yes. They're going to want to complain. They're going to want to borrow somebody else's coat. They're going to want to. So you tell them in advance, here's the deal. You're big. You're 10. You can make this call. You don't get to borrow somebody else's coat. We're not leaving early, and we're not going to allow you to whine. But we're going to let you make this call. Then what happens is they go, and they are uncomfortable, and they're unhappy, and whatever else, and that's fine. They just get to deal with that. But if you're going to the zoo in November in Anchorage, Alaska, and they say, I don't want to wear a coat, you say, tough, put on a coat. That's a consequence. They can't survive. They might freeze to death. And so that's what you want to be fighting for, is when can we give them the freedom and knowing they can survive? And we're still there with them. We're still there to go through this with them. I honestly will tell you, I hope that when my kids get old enough to move out, when they're ready to move out, I want to be handing them the last one or two coins. And those are the coins that come with anyone who lives under a roof I own. So that if one of you came to live in my house, you would have to hand over those two coins as well. Any adult would. And so at that point, it's down to just these last coins. So that philosophy is going to dictate a lot of the answers you're going to get to the question when you ask questions tonight, as to what can they handle, what can they survive, and then how do we be the agents of freedom? We're the ones trying to push freedom on them. That way they're not almost guaranteed to not have to fight for that freedom later, which is what we face with teenagers very often, is that parents have been so restrictive about freedoms. And by the way, if you try a freedom and you realize it was too much, then what do? You take it away. It's not that big a deal. And they get mad about it. And that's fine too. So anyway, that's a basic philosophy. Freedom-based parenting. How do we get freedom out of the, how do we get those coins out of the hands of the parents into the hands of the kids? If that's the parents' philosophy, it really helps that you're intentional about creating that and making sure they're ready for it when it happens. Okay, so now, First, I'll say any questions on that, but then moving forward, we literally at this point are open to questions for the next hour. So, ish. So, ready? Go. Yes, sir. Other examples of that? Okay, cool. Do you guys have one when it comes to mind? Okay, thank you. The question was, are there other examples of, like, the coat analogy? Are there other specifics? Do you have one in mind, Jason? Okay, cool. We can try that. Thoughts, guys? You can take it out of there if you want.
I'm just going to set that there. Oops.
I got a clean spot on the stage, John.
One of the areas I see that works really well for young kids, which is one of the areas that I get to have because I have a 3.5-year-old, a 2-year-old, and a newborn, is whenever you're trying to help them kind of make decisions on their own. So even if it's things like what they get to wear, I mean, I've had my kid wear, you know, stripes and polka dots, which makes my poor wife, you know, a little bit on edge. But being able to kind of make little decisions like that where they're able to kind of express themselves, be a little creative. That's generally what I see works really well is kind of the little, just them expressing themselves in a different way at the very young ages. Junior high, it gets a lot trickier because there's so many more things where they are kind of those dangerous things, whether it's, you know, what they're hanging out with, who they're spending time with, what they're watching on TV, YouTube, whatever it is. A lot of times there, it becomes a lot more of a collaboration where you're trying to show your child that they can have a say in their life, but that they don't have the ultimate say. And really that you as the parent don't have the ultimate say either, that God has the ultimate say. And so whether it's what type of video games they play or what they do with their friends, what sport they play, those would be some of the examples that first come to mind for me as ways that you can kind of come alongside your child and try to help them be able to kind of take those steps where they're talking through with you, this is why I want to play basketball in sixth grade or seventh grade. Something like that would be the first area that comes to mind for me. Anything you want to add, Chris?
There's actually just tonight talking about Hank. How old is Hank? 10. So Jeff and I were talking, and so Hank has played baseball for the last, would you say, 2 or 3 years? And this year Hank wanted to play soccer. Well, that's a lot of times parents freak out about that kind of thing, right? That's when it's time to shame. Thanks, man. That's when it's time to shame the kid about, I joked about, like, so I'm sure you made sure he felt awful for being a quitter, right? I mean, that's an important training thing at that stage. Like, oh, so you're a quitter, huh? Quitters never win. That, instead to say, okay, well, here's the deal. Exactly what Jeff said, like, well, here's the deal. Once you start, we're going to finish what you started. But then there's a clear breaking point when, okay, you can decide that. And again, a lot of times parents freak out about those type of decisions. So little kids and big. One of the things I tell teenagers is they want to be their parents' consultant. And so learning that a parent learning that a child can be trustworthy is huge. This is a great lesson to teach your preteens. Is say there's going to come a day when they're going to say, hey, I want to go over to Larry's house. And you're going to say, is that a good idea? And when your child says, well, yeah, that's a good idea. Are they a consultant to you? Or are they now a counter-consultant to you? Like, well, if you think it's a good idea, then it probably isn't. And a lot of parent teenagers, the teenager is so untrustworthy, they develop that. And so for parents fighting for those freedoms to let them try to do it and fail and keeping up on them and that kind of stuff. But I'll tell you one of ours, Jason, is we had, and we've got another one coming up who's 3, who was very timid. I'm going to stand up so I can see you. Who was timid. And so when Ellie was probably about 4 or 5, and her saying, I want to get quarters to play with the little vending machine. And I said, well, here's a dollar. Go to the cash register. Go up to the lady behind the cash register and get a quarters. And she was like, I can't do that. I was like, well, then I guess you won't get the quarters. So you're going to have to decide to go do that. And so for her to step out of her comfort zone to go, and of course, everyone knows what she did. What'd she do? She asked Mom. And so we worked to where Mom walked a part of the way with her. And because because we work intentionally as a team, Mom didn't say, of course I will. She said, well, what did your dad tell you? He said, I had to do it on my own. Okay, well, here's what we'll do. Tell you what, is this okay, Chris, if I just, you know, we'll walk her a few feet and then she can go the rest of the way. And so that was where we ended up. But anyway, all kinds of, with kids at movies, books, that we're the one challenging them with the deeper concepts. I don't mean inappropriate material. I mean deeper concepts and more challenging concepts and then talking it through with them. Anything you would add?
Just say that treat each kid as an individual. Don't be afraid if one sibling can do something earlier than the other sibling. You have to look at their decision-making process. Is one more impulsive than the other? How they handle disappointments, how they tackle failures. So look at each kid independently when you're making decisions for them, and don't let it be a sibling thing where everyone gets to do this at 10 or everyone gets to do this at 12. Looking at them individually and see how they can handle it.
Very good word. Questions about rites of passages? So, and I'm doing this for the audio as well, so that not only everyone can hear it, but recording later. You guys have thoughts on, I know you've got thoughts on rites of passages. I don't know if we've ever talked about that, so I'll be interested to hear. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's a big question. I think with rites of passages, the more that you do, it's so much about what Chris was talking about earlier about freedom. And so a kid is naturally designed, I think, by God to want to have that freedom. They want to grow up. I mean, you see that with the youngest kids, where they want to be able to be like their dad. They want to be like their mom or someone else that they know, or everyone, really. And so the more that you're kind of opening the door to them to these new freedoms, whether that's a new choice, a new opportunity, things like that, the more you can do, the better. Are you looking for some specific examples as well? Okay. I love her rites of passages to include both an opportunity and a new responsibility. So if it's a freedom, something that they really wanted to do, like being able to play on the sports team is what I used earlier, that could be an example. But also then they have a new area of a chore or something that they're now helping out, something that they're now starting to do with the family. I think budgets can be a great way to go whenever they're a little bit younger, where they actually get a little allowance or they actually have a little bit of money that they're learning how to save, how to tithe, what it looks like to give generously with what God has given you. That can be a little rite of passage for a younger child. As they get older, it becomes a lot more clear. You know, the classic is kind of the car keys. You know, whenever they hit whatever teenage scary year that is, when we as parents start to get a little nervous about that one. But there's so many along the way, and especially as the kid starts to see that they have an active participation in their growing up and that God is equipping them through you, kind of the more they see that, the more they want to jump at it. And so, like, right now, with my very, very young child, we're helping him learn just for the very first time how to do itty-bitty chores. He's nowhere near ready. He's 3 and a half. But he's starting to learn. He's excited that he's actually able to help mom start to take things out of the dishwasher, which is hilarious to me because that's, like, my least favorite chore in the world. So there's some intentional two reasons why we're doing that one. But with all of us, he's starting to learn that responsibility. Once he gets that, then the new opportunity may be a new movie he gets to watch or a new something that he's able to do with his friends, maybe spending the night with friends whose families we very closely trust and know, because we've honestly kind of screened them a little bit. But those would be a couple of things that come to my mind. Anything y'all want to add?
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you, a rite of passage is anything that communicates to another person, especially a child or someone who you're mentoring, that you see them differently. I now see you as this. You were this, now you're this. And it's so obviously the parent, one of the main jobs of parents and grandparents is to do that, is to have those rite of passage. Sometimes it's as simple as a conversation. So there's an intentional parenting, as Josh was talking about. There are going to be hundreds, maybe thousands of small examples of rites of passages. One of the things that helps us be faithful to do that is to also schedule some big rites of passages. Some family-based rites of passages, some culture-based rites of passages. So, for example, the one you mentioned in our families at age 5 is when you get to see Star Wars. And it's a family event. And, in fact, Ginger's godbrother typically comes in from out of town or we go to his place to watch. I mean, it's a big family kind of thing. It's just, it doesn't matter that it's Star Wars. It's just fun. And so, now, interestingly enough, my guess is Michael will not see Star Wars when he's 5. In fact, he turned 6 in January, and we've not even considered it. And so he's going to have to be older, so he won't be ready at 5 for that experience of seeing. Really, for us, David, it is seeing a bad guy, seeing a good guy lose. And to begin to understand that life works that way sometimes on earth. Because until then, you don't see good guys lose. And so in that movie, there's a powerful message that sometimes being the good guy means you lose. And that's okay. Still the right to be the good guy. So that's part of the conversation. Then there are, in my family, you probably know this, you may or may not know this, but we also follow the ages of knighthood, rites of passage. And so at 7 is squire. No, 7 is page. And we have a special conversation with them at 7. They get to invite a friend and his dad to go to Dallas jousting, medieval times. And we get to have that big celebration, and we talk about he is now a contributing member of the family and not just a passive recipient. Now, the family up until now, although he may have done some little chores and that kind of stuff, let's be honest, you're not really helping. It's more of a hassle than not to have you. We're training you. That's fine. That's good. But that's about to change. And so now you're a contributing member of the family. You're going to be offering input. And so in my family, the gift for that son is a small Leatherman tool that he doesn't get to carry it around with him everywhere because they lose it in like 15, 16 seconds, but it's a, it sits in a certain place. They use it when dad tells them, hey, go get the tool. And I then intentional about this would be a great place where instead of pulling one of the knives out of my pockets, I'm going to send him to his room to go get his and come. And so that's a part of that. So at 7, then 11 is sex talks, where we talk about what it means to be a man, a young man in regards to sex. We do those on canoe trips, which Holland is doing his first one this year. Some of y'all are going on this canoe trip. So I'm giving more detail than you may want. But then so that's 11. So there's 3 years, 9, 10, and 11. We do those three talks. Those are online in detail. Ginger does the same thing with our daughters at about the same age. She has the sex talks there. And then at 14, we do 14 is Tomahawk, and we have a bunch of men over. And the men all come in and speak what it means to be a man, what they think it means to be a man, into the 14-year-old. And then at about 17, when Mark is almost 17, is we'll do an adventure rite of passage. He'll do something adventurous that he's never considered being able to do, and it'll probably, whatever I know he's kind of afraid of. And then whenever marriage comes, or 21, whichever is sooner, we have a couple more things in mind. And so it's very intentional with the guys. It's a little less specific with the girls, but there's some very specific things we do. It's just we only had the one daughter until now, so it's kind of like we can do this along the way with Ellie when it seems fitting, but with Emma, we're now going to have to think of some new things. But there's so many different great examples of rites of passage throughout history. The Native American culture has amazing ones. You've probably heard me teach about the Maasai culture in Africa, has some really cool ones. The ancient Japanese, there's some great models to follow, but it is however, and the dads and moms, you want to be as intentional. So some of us who grew up out in the woods, we had rites of passages given to us, but usually not very intentionally. In fact, I can show you this. So when you're a kid, when you go bird hunting, you take what? No. With your parents, your dad gets what? Which gun out of the gun cabinet? Maybe BB gun. In my family, we didn't own BB guns. Guns aren't toys in my family. A shotgun. Which shotgun? What matters is which gauge. 410 for a child. 410 is a child's gun. 20 gauge is a woman's gun. 12 gauge is a man's gun. My family, there was no uncertainty about that. So when you were a child, you took the 410. When you were a young man, you took the 20 gauge. When at some point, and dad didn't talk about this. So if my dad had known better, this would have been, son, today when we go to the gun cabinet, something's going to be different. My dad didn't know to do that, but he certainly, when my dad reached into the gun cabinet and took the 12 gauge instead of the 20 gauge, the first year that happened, and handed it to me, I knew he sees me differently than he did last year. Something has changed. It's cool if he'd have known to say, so in my family, when you're a child, you load firewood. When you're a young man, you haul firewood. When you're a little bit older young man, almost a man, you split firewood. When you're a man, you wield the chainsaw. And each year, it was, what was I going to be given? And I remember very distinctly the year dad said, all right, I think this is the year for you to be the one cutting, and I'll haul. And I mean, it's terrifying, and I'm scared. Like, do I know how to do this? But he's going to talk me through it. He's there. This could kill me or him. I mean, this is like, we're not playing. And so it's kind of funny. And by the way, we only use one-wheel wheelbarrows in my world. And to this day, I will not own a two-wheeled wheelbarrow. There's something taught by a one-wheeled wheelbarrow. There are character traits taught by that nothing else in the world can teach. If you've never had to fight one all the way to the ground and lose the entire load and have to deal with that moment, you're not a man. It's like, you've got to experience that in order to be able to say, like, if you can, because you can handle that moment, there's almost nothing frustrating that will cross your boundaries after that. I'm a big fan of that. But I know it's a simple question, but this is clearly, and I mean, Josh would have known this for sure, but this is something I'm very passionate about. And I think the church, the family, has always got to be the seat of rites of passages, and most families do none. And the church is the next best chance for it. And so we actually do some very intentional things at this church to communicate rites of passage, that we see you differently. So you were this, and now you're this. You want dozens of examples all the time. but then have some very specific, this is how. Raising a Modern Day Knight, I'm not a fan of everything in the book, but has some good basic stuff in it as a good book. Yes, sir. You go.
I think the first thing I would do as a parent is to help the kid differentiate between a healthy friendship and an unhealthy friendship, because kids, sometimes those lines get blurred, especially, what age is it? 11. Being able to teach that kid age appropriate, what is a healthy relationship versus unhealthy. Also giving her tools to kind of communicate her pain or her sadness or frustration or anxiety, because the cutting is really just kind of an outcry for something deeper, and that is her tool to get it out. So being able to teach her daughter tools when she is depressed or anxious or frustrated, ways to communicate that and ways to get that pain out that doesn't involve self-injury, I think counseling would definitely be appropriate.
Yes.
When you have someone doing self-harm behaviors, can escalate quickly, and that can be a long-term issue for her if she doesn't understand how to express her emotions in a healthy way. So the first thing I would do is make sure she knows what healthy and unhealthy relationships are. Probably set some pretty firm boundaries on the amount of time, if any, she's allowed to spend with this person, especially as negative of an impact as she's already had. And also get her talking to someone where she can express herself in a healthy way and learn some coping techniques, and to teach her about the self-harm behaviors, because I think that's really important. That can be a long-term issue.
And the longer it goes, the worse it's going to get. And it can become an obsessive addiction. So you want this dealt with quickly. If in the first few months you can catch a cutter then very often it becomes kind of a phase. Mm-hmm. And you can even help them identify it as that, like, oh, you remember back when you used to do that type of thought? If it gets deeply ingrained, it can become pretty psychotic.
Especially in groups. Like groups can, friends that have another friend that does it, it can kind of, other friends want to try it and do it, so it can become kind of a group thing. So getting her away from that influence is hugely important.
You have to be prepared as a parent to do things like, even if it means taking a kid out of a school and moving to a different school, as awful as that is, and trying to engage with and help this other child's parents as well. It's going to take a relationship, though. That's the main reason we've been hesitant to get into the kind of web counseling thing, is that if you don't get the chance to develop a relationship outside of that, it's very restricted. I mean, it may be helpful, but it's going to be not nearly as helpful, I think. And I mean, I'm biased, but they need to get that little girl in with Allison like last week. And so anything you can do to help make that happen. Good.
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 Very good.
Yeah. Good, that's good. Yeah, there's a lot to cutting.
Yes.
And a lot of kids go through a phase of it because it's now well known, mm-hmm. that they kind of experiment with it. But most kids are able to move past it, especially with a little bit of help, relatively easily. But if everybody freaks out and the world collapses and no one knows what to do, and or we all pretend like it's not a problem or we deny it or whatever, they're medicating something. Yeah, good question. Mm-hmm. I'll comment on friendships too with kids. Rarely, especially of that age, but even of older, rarely do we as parents have to forbid friendships. All we have to do is starve them out. We hold the purse strings. So we get to decide a big portion of what our kids do. And so if there's certain friendships that you want to encourage, then you make sure that the doors of heaven are open in those friendships, right? And the friendships that you want to discourage, so I've used this, my dad has a spiritual gift of wisdom. Again, he didn't know a lot of this stuff necessarily, just very wise. I dated a girl who was 2.5 years older than me when I was 16. Dad didn't know her that well, wasn't pumped about me dating a girl that much older. And so, I mean, when I was dating her, it was like, hey, I'm going out with this girl, and what time do I need to be home? Like, well, I think you ought to be home by 9:30. Be like, wow, that's kind of early. Like, yeah, well, but I think you need to be home. And, okay, well, I was thinking about taking her to the movies. Can I borrow $20? Like, hey, if you want to take her to the movies, you better work. Get $20 and whatever. And so then after a while, needless to say, this almost 19-year-old girl wasn't interested in the 16-year-old boy who had to be home by 9:30, right? It was like, she was like, I'm moving along here. And the next girl I dated, I remember being like, hey, Dad, I'm taking Amy out, and what time do I need to be home? He's like, I think 11's probably fine. I'm like, 11? Like, when did that change? And he would literally be like, oh, and do you need money for the movies? Do you need some, here's some extra for popcorn? And be like, what happened? He's like, unapologetically, my dad said, I like Amy. So I helped that one. And he didn't ever need to forbid. You may not see this. And she was, by the way, she was fine. She was a neat girl. But that whole picture of that works. So an 11-year-old friendship, you don't have to forbid anything. It just never seems to work out to get together with her. And the number was lost on your phone, or you don't get your phone for a while, or there's always an excuse to take things away from kids. That's not hard, especially at that age. And that's so to being able to kind of, without creating a martyr out of this friend, to be able to say, or even better, there was actually a family, I won't give you any details on this, but a relatively wealthy family who would come to me for counseling, and the mom at one time was like, I just can't figure out how to get my daughter to have the right friends. And I was like, okay, you're super wealthy. Why don't you bring in Justin Bieber and only invite the friends you want her to hang out with? Like, create a phenomenal memory with her and three or four friends who you want her to have lifelong friendships with. Because especially at that age, friendships are based on common experience. And so do that. I mean, be intentional, engage on that. You don't have to tell her, you know, you're not allowed to speak to this friend. You go, well, I'm sorry, she can't, you know, call that mom and say, when are you all out of town? And the next time they're out of town, have a cool event at your house that little girl, oh, she can't make it. I mean, I'm not afraid of gaming the system for the sake of our kids like that. So you're first.
Yeah, thanks. Do it early and often. I mean, there's so much out there, and it's becoming just more pervasive, where our kids are getting to where they're a lot smarter than we are as adults with how to access the internet, especially unfiltered internet. And so, I mean, you know, especially when we have those rites of passage like we talked about earlier, a lot of what you would do if, you know, the rite of passage is they're able to have, you know, a Wii U or something like that that can access the internet, or an Xbox, you know which games they are, you know, and have clearly reviewed what is on there on the games, and you have restrictions already set up. And that's the deal, is, okay, they get to use this for however much you deem fit, but you have the restrictions already put on place. There's some great resources out there. HeartlightMinistries.org has a lot of very practical how-to models for how to regulate computers, cell phones, things like that. But, I mean, our kids are being thrown out there, and it's not just pornography or, you know, unsolicited material. It's also the bullying that goes on pretty innocuous apps like Twitter or Facebook that a lot of us may have on our phone right now. But these kids are just getting thrown to the wolves with how much other kids are just being absolutely cruel on those kinds of things. And so that's something we have to monitor as well. There's a lot of good resources out there. Secure Teen is an app that I've seen that works really well. And then you don't need to hide it. You just need to have the conversations, right, like Chris was talking about with that rite of passage that goes hand in hand, where you're having these conversations at, you know, age 11 about what's out there, and you're helping the kid understand the danger, but also the opportunity they have to really show themselves as a responsible young boy or young girl that's continuing to grow. So that would be where I would start.
Any thoughts?
I would teach them like good online habits early on, no matter how young they are, what's appropriate, what's not appropriate. Be a good model yourself for good rules and boundaries for electronics. I would make sure they're aware of all the of any dangers. I'd have firm house rules, like no electronics at dinner or no electronics in the bedrooms, or there's a family computer that everyone uses, and be prepared to be a good role model yourself. I'm a big proponent of knowing your kids' passwords. I know kids do not want to hear that, but being aware, don't be in the dark about what they're looking at, who they're talking to. Ask questions, be aware, you know, ask other parents, are there websites I need to be aware of, or, you know, different things pop up every day. So be a good role model, no passwords, be aware of what they're doing, model good behaviors, and give good, firm, consistent boundaries for the house.
You can tell we talk about this a lot. Everybody's got kind of a spiel ready. I agree with everything they said. I think one of the things that's vital is that you start creating things, making things normative at the beginning. Mm-hmm. Just like you, when you're raising a dog as a puppy, you turn it over on its back and you spread its paws out and you pull its ears a little bit, and so that it learns, like, my owner is allowed to do this. And so then when it's big enough to kill you, it doesn't when you have to do that for some reason. Your children, when they're young, I mean, my children understood from day one, they don't own anything. There's nothing that they own. we model that in that we don't own anything either. This is kind of theological, but it's fundamentally God's and we're stewards of it. Anything they own is owned by God and stewarded by me. And then I steward it to them, which means it's still mine. God can take it from me. I can take it from them. That's the picture. And therefore, there are no passwords that I don't have. What's funny is that when the first time my kids even heard that someone might have a password their parents didn't have, I don't think they knew that that was a physical possibility. Like, I didn't know that they knew that phones would do that or that computers would do that. I do not believe in unfiltered internet access anywhere. It comes at you, as you know, as a male, it comes at you hard and fast. I don't know how many spam emails I get that even make it through this spam system and then through the second spam system, and then I'm the one who have to delete because the systems aren't sure for sure if they're spam, but half of them are relatively pornographic. And so I have to delete them myself. And that is the thought of my children having unfiltered, that if they could click on one of those and no one would ever know, that's not. I mean, I can't imagine what it's like to be a teenage boy especially. And now we're seeing a huge rise in girls and pornography use. It's up to like 70 to 80%. Of girls are also experiencing pornography use. And so it's just, and 98, 99% of boys at some point. And so this is just it's become such a chronic problem. And most parents don't even know about the unfiltered internet access ports that their child has. So if you don't know that your televisions all go directly to the internet, your kids may know that. If you don't know that their little tiny kid version game system, LeapPad, may have unfiltered internet access, then you need to know that. If you don't know that every phone, every game system, all of the iPads and all of that, even kid ones, all have unfiltered. I'm getting nods from Cody over there. Cody's an IT guy, and Cody's like, I'm telling you, this is, it is unreal how many access ports there are to the internet in most of our homes. And I've had too many parents come up to me with a DS, a little Nintendo DS, going, I caught my son looking at pornography on this. I didn't know he could even get to the internet on this. Like, wait. Guess what? All of them. And so we have to be intentional and aware. That's another good reason that game systems and TVs don't need to be used unmonitored. You've heard me say before, I know I'm stepping on toes. I'm not concerned about that. I just am stepping on toes. I don't believe TVs are a place for a bed. Bedroom are a place for a TV. I don't think those go together for adults or kids. Everything that you say you want about your bedroom, you know, peaceful, quiet, restful, even romantic, those type of things, TVs go to war against that immediately. And so I'm not an opponent of TVs. Have a TV, fine. That's between you and God. We have a couple, but not in the bedroom, and certainly not in a kid's bedroom. That's just asking. That, again, that's something they can't survive. They don't understand the addictive power of the things that are on everyday normal TV, much less what's on everyday normal TV at 2:30 a.m., much less what's on three times a year when your cable company or satellite company, without letting you know, gives you free access to all the movie channels for a month that you may not ever notice, but if your teenager is checking every single day to see if it's on there, they spot it. And the pornography, the rank material that's going to be, like, I'm telling you, it's just the main thing is to be aware and to be engaged and to know what's going on and to not be afraid of the conversation. I totally agree with what Allison said. This is not, you don't need to be sneaky about it. You know what? That just encourages misbehavior. So you're not trying to. You're not a cop hiding behind the billboard trying to catch a speeder. You're a cop sitting out in the median, so everyone slows down when they see you. I mean, you want them to know. Hey, listen, this is. I'm watching everything. Mm-hmm. I remember when I was at Pine Cove, I told Cody one day. Cody was watching it, and I said, Cody, here's what I want to believe. I want to believe if I look at any inappropriate page anywhere in the world on any system that something dings on your computer. Like, that's what I want to believe. Like, and he's like, well, then that's what happens. I was like, good. That's all I needed to know. It's like that as the chaplain of Pine Cove, I'm going to have to talk with the CEO and the IT director when I look at something inappropriate, even if it's on someone else's computer in Thailand, that you're going to be like, Chris? So, like, I want my kids to know that. Now, are they going to have to face that someday on their own without my help? I have no doubt. But we model it. We engage with that conversation, and we give him the tools. We will give them all the tools to be successful there. Yes, they'll have to face it on their own, but I want them as old as possible when they face that. I was 5 when I saw my first pornography. I want Mark to be 25 And I'm sure it's a matter of if not when nowadays, sadly. But I want him to be an adult going like, look at that junk. Instead of being a five-year-old whose brain isn't even hardwired yet, who's going, something just changed for me forever. So anyway, there may be further questions on that. Yeah, or comments. Depends on, there will be some apps, like it's actually, it would be very, very difficult for you to access a search engine on this phone, because like Facebook has an internal app, an internal search engine. So you can link from Facebook back to the internet, even to Google. So no Facebook on my computer either. Yeah. There may not be on their phone then. They're getting to search. They're able to search. Then there's just an app that's allowing that. Do they have the password that to turn off the restrictions?
No, that's me.
That's you. Okay. Do you know how they're doing it?
The other ones do, so I'm going to get up there right now.
Yeah, absolutely. Figure out what it is, because
that's just smart.
So there's another way on. I don't want to know it. Say it when I'm not in the room, because I don't want to. I don't want to know. Comment, Cody.
I was just saying, I'll look at
yep. Great. That's okay. You like stand up so everybody can see you. Cody will help you protect your children. Cody actually has given me in the past, there's hardware that you can plug into your wireless system at your home that at least blocks a certain percentage from anyone who walks in your home who uses your wireless. They can't see certain things. So I'm sure it has holes in it, but probably pretty good. And that's what you want. You want all the barriers. You can't. And when you're an adult, by the way, I'm like, I have all these barriers in place. I mean... I'm a grown man. I can go buy a computer today and no one would know. But what you want is all the barriers between you and making bad decisions. The same thing for your kids with that.
Stupid to think that.
What do you think?
I would never assume that.
The question was, thank you. The question was, am I being stupid to assume that my kids just aren't interested in that and that I can't just tell them, hey, don't do that stuff.
Trust but verify. I think trust, but always be on the lookout, always ask questions, continually check any access they might have. You know, I'd always trust, but still check. Never assume.
Additional thought to that?
Yeah, I mean, keeping it in an open conversation and letting them know that that's something that you have the barriers for yourself, too. I find that tends to help teenagers a whole lot whenever they see, okay, mom and dad are in the trenches with me on this. Because there's so many things where it can become so tempting and the entire culture tries to make it be us versus our teens versus our young kids. Mm-hmm. And that's not the way it is with this situation. You know, Chris has the filters on his phone. I have the filters on my phone. My son's going to have the filters on his, because that's not a freedom issue. That's just poison. And so whenever you're able to have those kinds of things, it becomes a lot easier for you as the mom to your daughters, or, you know, you as the dad to your sons, being able to have those conversations just a little bit easier, because you're going through the exact same thing and you're keeping the exact same transparency about what you're doing to prevent it from happening.
You may not be there yet. That is possible. So most of the answer of your question is that is possible that they just haven't yet uncovered that or discovered that or whatever. Part of that's due with their educational system, who their friends are, all that kind of stuff plays really into that. That being said, yes, to think that you can just say don't do that and that that's going to be effective is foolish. There's a handful of, I'm sure, although I don't know, except for a handful of people in the room who deal with addictions of one type or another. There are very few addictions more powerful than the pornographic addiction. If you could just say don't do it, then all the addicts would just decide not to do it, because they've all decided 7,000 times not to ever do it. And so what you want to do is you want to be putting in. And the other problem is today you don't have to sneak off to the 7-Eleven and buy a dirty magazine. Like it's coming to them. It's going to seek them out. And that's part of the difference today, is it's coming. The pornography industry is one of the most vile, evil industries out there, and they are coming for our kids because they know they are absolutely dependent on hooking as many little kids as possible.
You also have to teach them kind of what your boundaries are, because when they go to friends' homes,
yeah,
they may have a whole other set of rules and freedoms, so they need to be able to know what is okay for them no matter where they are. So you may be safe at your house, but when they are outside your home, they need to be very clear on what is okay and what is not okay.
Good. Still same topic. Was there any more on this topic? Yes, sir. The comment here was about it's easier sometimes to hopefully, and I would say maybe all the time, to train a kid rather than to fix them. And so what are some of the training things that you can do, especially in regard to this topic? So I thought, do you guys have any specifics?
I mean, we're talking specifically about the internet and pornography. I generally try to start with something that's very similar at a younger age. So 4, 5, or 6, you know, whenever a friend of yours tries to steal something at the store or tries to lie to a coach, you know, at school whenever you're on the team, tries to cheat at a game they're playing, things like that. Being able to talk to them about how they come to you, come to a coach, talk about something wrong that's going on outside. A lot of times one of the easiest ways to do that is with the bullying that happens so often to our kids or to their friends, and just kind of how they can appropriately come to you about that kind of stuff. Because a lot of the kids are innocently exposed. They're not going out and searching it, like Chris said. They're being exposed to it. It accidentally pops up on a phone. It gets through somehow, a friend's phone, whatever it is. So if you're able to help them just kind of be like, okay, you know, you model, this is how you talk to me. You can come up to me and tell me something bad happened, and I'm not going to be mad at you. I'm not going to shame you. I'm not going to freak out. And then you teach them that whenever it's bullying, whenever it's something at school that's going on that they need to talk to you about when they're younger, it makes it a whole lot easier whenever it's something that's very personal and very shameful to a young kid, like, I just saw something I shouldn't have on the internet. If you've already kind of streamlined those conversations to where they're, it's still awkward, but they're a little more comfortable with it, I mean, that's half the battle won right there, because then you're able to then come alongside them and kind of move forward in that direction.
Good. Anything else? I would say another part of that training is what I was talking about earlier. I used to get asked regularly, like, at what age do I need to talk to my children about sex? And I would always say, I think 11 is the perfect age, but the world's not going to give you till 11, so you better start at about somewhere between 7 and 9. And you want to start this conversation with your children at an age-appropriate level. And we're a homeschool family. So if your kid's in public school or even private school, they're going to be introduced to the conversations about sex earlier. So you want to be the voice about these topics. Moral decisions, you want to be the voice of that. Here's why we don't this or do this. Here's why we don't this or do this. And so for Mark, what the 3 years are, the spiritual aspects of sex, these are the 3-year conversations. Although in that first one, I talked about how that anytime there's something good, we talk about fire. Fire is our training on any of these. And so fire is a good thing. It is a life-giving thing in the proper setting. Outside of that setting, it is deadly. Sex inside of the proper setting, which God designed, is awesome and life-giving. Outside of that setting, it is deadly. And so we'll say, like, I know you don't even know what I'm talking about at this point yet, but there you're going to see it. Maybe it's something that you shouldn't see. It's maybe something you shouldn't do. It's going to be somebody who wants to do something with you that they shouldn't do. These are all things that you need to be able to say, this is not, in your gut, you're probably going to have a strong sense of this doesn't seem right. And if you have that gut sense, then walk away, run away, do whatever you need to do, and then we'll talk about it. And it may be your gut's wrong, and we can talk about that and figure out this is okay. But it may be your gut is right, and you'll have me backing you on that. And you'll have my, whatever I can bring to the table. So the 3 years, we talk about the fire first and the spiritual power of anything like that, whether it's guns, which we have rites of passage about that in our family, or whether it's music, very powerful in a proper way, very powerful in an improper way, very dangerous. Medicine, I mean, the same medicine that takes away your pain when you're badly hurting can give you tons and tons of pain later when if you can't walk away from it. Pick anything like that, and you can talk about that with your kids, and fire is a great picture of it. So we talk through that. That's the spiritual aspects of sex, and then we talk about the other good stuff about the spiritual aspects of sex. The physical aspects of sex, just straight up biology. And not to get off on a tangent, but I've been amazed to hear recently some when they play with adults, when they ask adults to correctly identify anatomy, sexual anatomy, and how awful both genders are at not only their own anatomy, but the other gender's anatomy. Even people have been married for years. I'm like, yeah, you need to figure that out. get an encyclopedia or something. So, and then the broken aspects of sex. And that's when Mark found out what the timeout club was and why every time he teased his mother about going there, why she got so embarrassed. He never knew that. He picked up on that very early, that if he commented on the timeout club that Ginger would get really embarrassed. And so, of course, he always did, because that's what kids do. And so when I finally told him what it was, he was very, he had to, felt like he needed to apologize to his mom for all the years of harassing her about it. But anyway, so that's, those are the three kind of asks. And you do want, if you can, you want to get ahead of the world on those. And depending on where your kid's going to school and who their friends are, you need to know, you got to be willing to talk about those. And when they bring it to you, don't panic and have those conversations openly. They need to see you're not afraid of it. That's a big deal. Okay, there were some other hands. I just want to make sure that topic was kind of covered. Yes, ma'am. I mean, hypothetically. Yeah, exactly. If you're just making something up. Yeah. I'm just going to go ahead and comment directly on this one. So this is you guys may have something to think of after, but this is one of the aspects of, repeat the question. Sorry, they're kind of long questions, and so I've got to summarize them. Thank you. Keep reminding us, and y'all just keep pointing and whatever. So the question is about in divorced families, when you have one set that is more, I guess for lack of a better term, liberal with the rules and guidelines and restrictions than the other one is. Okay, so this is one of the biggest problems in divorce. This is one of the biggest problems for children in divorce is this right here. Because think about this. In a healthy marriage situation raising a child, which parent typically wins the day? The more conservative parent or the more liberal parent? In a normal healthy family? So if I say, I think Mark's old enough to watch The Matrix, and Ginger says, I don't think he's ready, which do you think happens? He does not watch The Matrix. The more conservative parent wins the day typically in a healthy family. Because someone's like, I can watch it next month. He can watch it next year. I mean, that's a natural, I don't think they're ready. And so the more conservative parent typically wins the day. They get their way in a healthy, normal family. And so which if she thinks, oh, I think they can do this, and I go, I'm not ready for them to do that or whatever, then we're going to wait. That's typically, now you may push each other. And certainly there have been times when me as the more liberal parent in some ways have, quote, won the day because we're talking about a boy and I'm the dad. And so Ginger's defers to me at times and is like, if you say that's okay, I'm going to go with you on that. But anyway, so that happens periodically. But I'll tell you what, I guarantee you when she says, Ellie's not ready for that. And I'm like, sure she is. She's like, no, she's not. Well, okay, then she's not. I mean, mom is 100. I guarantee you I would trust mom on that. Now, in a divorce setting, when you have two parents, one of whom is more liberal and one of whom is more conservative, who always wins the day? The liberal one. Always. Because if I say, if Ginger and I aren't married, if we're divorced and Mark's at my house, and I go, Mark goes, hey, can I watch The Matrix yet? What am I going to say if I think it's fine? Sure. Am I going to call his mom? Probably not. When he goes and homes and tells her and she thinks it was crazy, is she going to call me? Sure. Am I going to care? No. That's how this works. This is one of the damaging effects on kids in a divorce situation. The mistake that too many parents make that magnifies this is to try to balance out the liberal parent. Don't do that. So you become more conservative, more strict, more whatever. No. What you want to do is be a good, healthy, well-integrated parent who is finding freedoms that they can do and opportunities and responsibilities that they can survive. If the other parent disagrees, then it is totally okay to tell the child, we disagree. This is your dad. Your dad has decided you can watch Jaws. I think it's too early. But you watched it. So we'll be okay with that. We'll figure it out. We'll deal with it. If it doesn't cause any effects, great. Although, how many of you are between 40 and 50? How many of you are between 40 and 50? What's the number one phobia of people between 40 and 50?
Sharks.
Sharks. Absolutely. Isn't that amazing? Because we all saw Jaws too young. So is it likely, and even the people who live in Kansas, my age, their number one fear, sharks. It's unreal. I'm convinced for my kid's age, it's going to be either dogs or spiders because of the Harry Potter movies. That people were way too young seeing these very graphic, scary representations of spiders or dogs. So it's okay. We're all surviving it. Not very few of us. Is it crippling our lives to be afraid of sharks? Probably. Even if he develops a phobia of sharks, probably not going to cripple him, right? Is he maybe going to have nightmares on the cruise? Maybe. I mean, just like all the rest of us, right? So So the good news is, as mom, I would tell you, don't panic. If there's something that's abusive, then you confront it. If it's just more liberal than you're comfortable with, then you survive it, and you don't overly stress about it. There are kids who are probably facing a lot worse, so they're going to be fine, and your kids probably will too. What you want to do is be a great parent. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, you don't have to say, I don't think you're ready, and that says something bad about you. I just don't think you're ready. That's okay. I don't think you're ready to drive either. That doesn't say anything bad about you. I just don't think it's time, right? So that's just the same reason we're not opening Christmas presents tomorrow is because it's March. It's not time for Christmas presents. It's not time for you to do some of these things. Sure, I want to watch Jaws with you someday. It'd be great. It's not time. That's my opinion. Dad disagrees. So Dad lets you watch it. Hopefully everything will be fine. Yeah, I wouldn't make a big case out of it. If Dad will listen and co-parent at all, that's a great conversation. If he's not going to, there's nothing you can do about it, so I wouldn't stress. Kids are, even if it's not what's best, they do pretty well. Again, most of us were poorly parented about boundaries like that, and we've turned out okay. Maybe a little neurotic, but you know, what are you going to do? So that's my first advice: is don't panic. Scarred for life is a kind of a dramatic thought that we have too often. Sometimes, like, oh, they're messed up for life. Like, oh well. Gives them something to talk to their therapist about someday. Right? Sorry, keeps us in business. Yes, sir. Oh, good question. The question was, what do we immediately need to get help with our kids that we might not know we need help with? Sweet. I'm curious to hear what y'all think. Because I've got to think. I don't know. I've got to think about that. I mean, I know a few immediately, but they're kind of the obvious ones.
Obvious to you.
Self-harm, mm-hmm. Suicidal ideation, those are two obvious ones. Anything that seems to be disconnected from reality, not in an imagination sort of way. Mm-hmm. Again, imagination is, kids need that. But that they legitimately seem to think something is reality that isn't reality or vice versa. And those are things you want to jump on quickly, because the sooner you engage with obsessive compulsive tendencies, OCD tendencies, you might want to mention what should they be looking for anxiety stuff? Because anxiety can get worse quickly, especially in a child.
And it's hard to identify. A lot of times the kids will complain of stomach ache or headache, or, you know, I don't feel like going there, or that makes me uncomfortable. I'd say get kids that have a hard time identifying or talking about feelings, kids that are too internal, have a lot of anger, irritability, easily frustrated. Those kind of things can be signals of anxiety. But any kid that's not talking about how they're feeling, can't identify it, don't have a good emotional vocabulary to talk about things, that's things I would definitely kind of keep an eye out for.
With little
consistent
kids,
complaints.
Yeah. With little kids, sudden changes. So sudden changes in person, because that sometimes can indicate mm-hmm. a trauma or an abuse. Like they suddenly aren't potty trained anymore, or they suddenly can't sleep at all at night. Now, any kid can go through a phase like that, but mm-hmm. but especially if there's a dramatic and sudden change, a lot of times that's when it's good to involve a therapist. Even if it's just to get to know the therapist a little bit, you know, it's not a dramatic thing. And that's the cool thing about bringing kids to therapy is you think when you're coming to counseling, you're coming to the principal's office. Okay, that's what your wife dragged you there, you know, like, I'm going to get him fixed. That's the type of... Which is the vet, not the therapist, by the way. But they, you know, they come in and go to, and teenagers even will experience that, like, you know, and we all have experienced that, the parents who sit their teenager down and is like, you got to fix my kid. And we have a saying at our counseling center, you start with a child and you end with a couple. But this is a, those type of things for sure. Now, it is our business, and so this may sound kind of biased, like asking the, you know, air conditioning repairman how often you should get your air conditioning checked out. You know, like, oh, two or three times a week at least, right? And so, but rarely does, especially at a child's level, going to a therapist do them any harm. And so if there's a sense of like, gosh, they really seem to not be doing well with whatever. And we aren't, none of us are the, at least at our office, I can vouch for this, none of us are the, got to figure out a way to keep your kids around longer. You know, your kid comes in and we get to know them a little bit and are like, I think it'll be fine. I mean, that's not hard to do. And in case something doesn't come up, it's always nice if they know a counselor that they can feel more comfortable going back to. I've been amazed at the church. I wouldn't have predicted this. How many of you guys have been able to bring your child to see me because I'm just Pastor Chris. And so in the kid's mind, the kid probably doesn't care. Kids are a lot less freaked out about this stuff than parents are off most of the time. But those definitely come to mind. Any other?
I mean, other signs I look for include bullying whenever they start to lose friends and you don't know the reason. Like if there's a big shift in their friends, the way they dress, things like that. Not that there may be nothing there, but there could be something that's at least worth kind of checking in. Like Chris said, most kids come in and they're way more comfortable than you or I as adults would be going to a counselor. And so we have a good time. We play games. They go back. They think, you know, counseling was the greatest thing ever. And then you're just hoping that, you know, that they don't want to go for the rest of your life because of the bill. Most of the time, you know, these kids are just loving the fact that there's someone there that's investing in them, that's just hearing their life and not really trying to parent, because we're not parents, we're counselors. And we do a lot of things that a good parent will do, but what we're trying to do is mostly establish that relationship and then give you as parents the tools so that you can go off and continue to be great parents.
Yeah, so she was mentioning an example of, it's called trichotillomania, when a child pulls hair obsessively. It's just an anxiety disorder. And there's lots of different versions of that. When your child develops, and again, every kid has some of this, so again, it's hard to know, but when the kid has rituals that they have to go through in order to feel okay. And again, I say that, and everyone's going like, oh no, my child has to have their back rubbed, and then a story read, and a bottle of water, and all that's just con artistry. But when they have to do things a certain way, they can't sit on certain things, they can't touch certain things, or they have to touch certain things. Like those are, all kids go through anxiety. By the way, most kids go through a low-level anxiety disorder around age 7 or 8. They go to the bathroom more often. They become obsessed with something that's scary to them, especially if something scary has happened. Either their pet lizard died or a grandmother died or something like that. They'll kind of suddenly become afraid of stuff for a little while. Sometimes kids get in that and they get stuck and they seem to not be able to come out on the other side. And so that's a great one. But I'm not convinced for sure one way or another on this. I don't know that I've ever known a teenager that would not have appreciated getting to talk to an adult other than their parent, one who would listen to them and that kind of stuff. That doesn't have to be a counselor. That can be somebody else's parents, their friend's parents or something. But when I teach a teenage seminar, one of my big ones is you must involve other adults in your life of your teenagers. You are an idiot. They know everybody else's parents are not. They're cool. How come you're not cool like Larry's parents? Which, of course, he's telling his parents, how come you're not cool like so-and-so's parents? I mean, everybody's parents are cool, but yours, they're who are just total awful people. And most kids go through at least a phase of that. They may not all. And if you do a good job engaging and joining them in their world, I don't think you see too much of that, a ton of that. But most kids, you get a little bit of that. But whether it's a counselor or a mentor or something like that, I'm a big, big fan of that for teenagers especially, but even younger. But yeah, those are the ones I kind of listed. Those are the kind of, okay, drop everything, call us. When you get suicidal ideation or words, when you get obsessive type of things going on, harming themselves, very serious stress symptoms, those type of things. Josh is right, and Josh is kind of an expert on bullying, but I'll tell you, that is crippling. That's crippled a lot of people. For years, it was kind of, you know, laughed off like, yeah, kids do that. And now we're discovering that, you know, 2 or 3 kids in every class essentially don't ever recover from, if they are the sacrificial lamb of that class, they don't ever recover. And so we see that in adults now. And so we've learned we have to engage with that problem. And you can't, unfortunately, I don't trust the world to do it well, certainly not the government to do it well. And so they put out their infomercials. But if the school system is handling it great, if they're not handling it well, don't stop pushing until they deal with it well or pull your kid. Because if your kid is the sacrificial lamb, you want them out. If they're the one who have the cooties, you want them out. Because either that needs to change or something in that system is... I will tell you, working at Pine Cove showed me that bullying is not an absolute necessity. This is not an advertisement for Pine Cove. I'm sure there are lots of camps that do this well. But it was amazing to me to see how little of that junk went on at that camp because of the training and investment of the students. And I mean, of the students who are leaders, the college students, that they just, and the minute they see it, they engage with it, they deal with it. And the kids need that. They're children. I mean, they would eat each other if there weren't adults around. And so they have to engage and lead them well. So that's one. You don't want kids stuck. Yes, ma'am. That's a great question. Well, I think we all handle it the same way, so I think any one of you can, you want to jump on that? The question was, how much ethically can you disclose to the parents when you're working with children or teenagers?
I kind of go on an age range basis. If it's a preteen, adolescent, teenager, I always have both parents in the room and ask if I can offer the teen full confidentiality unless what needs to be reported to the parent would be a danger to themselves or someone else or something they really need to know to parent the child well. And I always tell the teenager, if mom and dad are on board with that, then everything stays private. Anything that I would report to parent, I will let you know first. So they never wonder what is being reported to the parent. So I always say, anything I tell mom and dad will go through you first. I'll tell you this is exactly what I'm going to tell them. If we need to tell them together. So there's no question. Younger kids, there's a lot more communication with the parents, and younger kids are usually okay with that because it's a lot of parenting teaching that goes on, but it's really important to build that rapport with adolescents and teenagers and to have that confidentiality, but you have to have both parents on board with allowing you to do that because not all of them do that.
Mm-hmm. In Texas, I think it's still 16. 16 and under has no confidentiality protection from parents, none. Mm-hmm. And so you have to establish that with the family first. What's amazing is after a teenager especially trusts me, very often I will say like, hey, it's about time for me to meet with your parents. So I'm going to ask them to come into a session. What do I need to tell them? Mm-hmm. And the child will start just saying like, oh, they need to know this. They need to know this. And so it's amazing. I know this sounds so shocking. Maybe you can tap back into the teenage soul. But teenagers actually really don't carry secrets well. And so they really do want to have a parent they can trust to handle their secrets well. And so I've spent whole sessions strategizing with a teenager how to prepare their parents to hear a secret that is why the parents brought the teenager in the first place. And the parents know all about this. And they're just, and so we're strategizing how the parents, and so we've all probably done where you meet with the parents for a full hour and you coach the parents. They're going to tell you this and you're going to handle it this way. And I've had teenagers, we talk through that kind of stuff. And so it's been fascinating that it's been much less of an issue than I had predicted it would be. But I think, and you do that too, right? We establish with the parent in advance and the teenager mm-hmm. sitting there. So you'll know you have no confidentiality protection. You have confidentiality, the way I say this, from everyone in the entire world except two people. Ironically, that's probably the two people you want confidentiality protection from. And so we're going to make an agreement here, mom and dad. If you absolutely need to know something, you have to trust me that I will make sure you know it. If you don't trust me to that level, then don't bring your child to me for counseling. If you're willing to trust me to that level, then we'll move forward. And the teenager, will you trust me? And then they have to trust mom and dad not to just walk in and say, now tell me everything. Because mm-hmm. the parents have the authority to do that. And you, as an under 18, I can't not do it. So I have never but one time in a court situation had a parent break that rule. And that's in 25 years of therapy. I've never had a parent but one time do that. Because obviously, I mean, if you're bringing your teenager in, there's a reason. If you're bringing your teenager in and I say, and they know, if I'm just playing messenger boy, everything the teenager tells me, I'm telling mom and dad aren't stupid. They know the teenager's not going to talk about anything. And so it's actually not that hard to do that. But so that's the technical answer is the parent of a minor can learn anything. But the way we set it up is we create a deal where that's not the way it plays out. And again, it's very effective. It's a good question. We'll make sure you know what you need to know, either from us or from them, typically from them. Good question. We got a few more time. Yeah. The question was, when is a good age to start disciplining your kids? We spank neonatally, so I don't know about... Sorry. Disciplining your children starts the instant you hold them. If you mean punish them, which is one small part of discipline. So discipline, I started answering again without asking them for input. What would you guys say?
That sounded good.
Yeah. I was on the right path? Good.
Yeah, I mean, with discipline, we started very, very young with both of our kids that were old enough. I mean, little things, just even telling them this was wrong. And then whether it was, you know, they lost a toy for 30 seconds because they were a year and a half old, 2 years old, things like that. We started young because we really had to with our oldest because he was about as strong-willed as he could come at two. Now 3 and a half, it's been going a whole lot better, thank God. And so what we've done a lot is very, very small disciplines that really kind of point towards repentance. So we're not really big into grounding or anything like that, and I don't think we ever will be for long periods of time. What we do is little bits of discipline. And granted, my kids are so young that, you know, 10 minutes feels like 4 hours. A day feels like 2 years to them. That's what we're doing now. What I do with a lot of kids that are a little bit older than mine, so, you know, starting to talk elementary age, junior high, even high school, is I'm trying to help discipline be a point of repentance, not a point of punishment. I'm not trying to get to where the punishment is so bad that there's no way my kid would ever do something like go out, sneak out, do something, kind of the things that we as parents would be afraid of. Because there's going to be things that basically short of me abusing my child, it's still going to look better to do whatever that sin is out there. So what we try to do instead is actually try to give them little disciplines along the way to where they are having to repent, having to apologize, and reconciling that relationship with you, which is so important for a kid. So I love doing little disciplines that can kind of build up rather than kind of the big disciplines, because what I've done is, let's say I have a 10-year-old, I ground him for a week from, you know, something that he loves. I've just lost all power with my kid for probably 5 and a half days. If I did it for a month, I just lost all power with my kid for 3 and a half weeks. What's better is to give them the little bit of discipline, so that way then you are setting yourself up as the parent to always win, rather than setting it up to where the kid can kind of whittle you down with whatever that is. So, Chris Nelson, you may want to tag on to that.
You first. That's good. Okay, so, yeah, so discipline just means doing something that doesn't come naturally to you or that you don't want to do. And so teaching a child, as adults, hopefully we have some self-discipline. That is a hope on my part that someday I will develop self-discipline. But with children, we have to do the disciplining for them. That's actually where that comes from. Adults discipline themselves. Children cannot discipline themselves. Therefore, parents do the discipline for them. We guide them to do the things they don't want to do or that don't come naturally to them. They're fallen, broken creatures of evil, sin, and dust. I mean, that is they. If you have any kids, the idea that anybody would say there's no such thing as original sin is mind-boggling to me. Apparently, they've never worked with any children ever. Children can lie and cheat and steal and abuse and do all those things. They're incredibly selfish and all that, and they don't have to be trained to do that. They do that naturally. So our job as parents, now part of that is to intentionally discipline. Punishment is only one of the tools. Guidance, teaching, rewards, and modeling, planning. This is one of the mistakes a lot of parents make is if you ask them, what do you want your children to walk away from your family with? They've never thought about it, never talked about it. Well, how do you guide someone towards something when you don't know what the destination is? And so that's a big one for me that I want to encourage people to do, is to say, we want our child to have this. We all learn rules from our family. Most of them were unintentional, right? So instead, what we want to do is teach our children intentional rules about life. My kids probably could tell you that one of our rules is, we reward hard work. I think that's a good rule to learn. Typically, hard work is rewarded. Not always, but so we reward hard. That's an example of something that I want them to have because I want them to learn to work hard. I think that's just a good thing to learn. Now, that's not the top thing, but that is an example of something. So we're looking for opportunities for them to work hard. And then when they do, we all celebrate that. We all throw a big party for that. We all go out to eat. We all get ice cream. We pay them if that's what seems like the best way to reward them. They want to be in control of what the reward is. They don't ever get that. So you're going to pay me for this? Like, well, we'll see. Remember, because it may not be pay, but we reward hard work. So that's they know that that's somehow there will be a reward that follows this hard work, and that's awesome. But discipline, so one part of discipline is punishment. The punishment needs to be appropriate for the age. style, temperament of the child. I totally agree with what Josh is saying. The smaller the punishment for the smallest of infractions is so much better than the huge punishments for the big infractions. The reason we don't do it that way is because we are lazy. And so that's why when we see in the store, we see the child go, "Mom, I want some candy." "You can't have any candy." "I want some candy." "You can't have any candy." "But I want some candy." And so 15 minutes later with the child screaming and kicking, all that kind of stuff, either the parent over-punishes, "You can never have candy again for the rest of your life." Or they give in. And children aren't stupid. One, they know that you're not going to really follow through with "you can never have candy for the..." "I'm just going to leave you here." Yes. So let's traumatize our child and lie to them, right? That's great discipline. But instead, when you can say, "You've now asked twice for candy. You may not have candy. If you ask me a third time, when you get home, you're going to have 10 minutes of sitting sitting on the carpet and not... you'll be able to move. You just got to sit there if you ask again." So why wait until you... Well, the reason is because we're lazy and we don't want to put out the energy to parent well until we're mad. And then we've got a bunch of energy to spend, right? But the problem is then we're punishing with anger. And I don't mean punishing in anger. I mean punishing with anger. That's how most of us were disciplined as a child. Is the main form of punishment was our parents' bad emotions. You can ask yourself, if you think back on that, like, were you afraid of getting spanked? Maybe. Were you afraid of getting a timeout? Maybe. Were you afraid of your dad getting angry? Yes. And so often what that indicates is dad was disciplining with, not just in anger, but with anger. I had one parent who would even say that, like, you don't want to make me angry. You're right, I don't. So I guess I will modify my behavior and hate your guts. But I'll modify my behavior. I will humor you until the minute I can get out from under your control. And that's what we're training our children to do, is to modify our emotions, is to manipulate our emotions when we discipline with our emotions. Of course, we're going to be emotional. I mean, they're infuriating. Children can be infuriating, right? I mean, you don't have to admit anything. I will do it for you. The idea when I did not have children, the idea of shaken baby syndrome was like, who would ever do that? And then there's a moment when you're holding a baby, and at that moment you go, this is how that happens. Right now is when that happens. Right now is when, if I didn't know better and did not have self-control and did not know how this worked, I would have just shaken my child. Like that, you could totally see that. You can see how this, and so that is and that's a baby. You know they're just being a baby, and yet you are done. You've not had any sleep, and you know your spouse hates you, and it's awful right now, and everything is bad. And on top of that, this stupid kid. I mean, you just have that. And at 2 and 3, they test you because that's their job. That's a great rule, by the way, about discipline. Don't take disciplining your child personally. It's not about you. It's about them. So of course they're going to be jerks when they're 2 and 3 years old. That's what their job is to be. They got to figure out what's real and what's not. You don't know unless you kick it. And so that's vital to understand. This is. So you start disciplining immediately, intentionally. You redirect when they're tiny. We don't touch that. And we don't sit there. We don't climb on that. We don't, when they get older. And I am not philosophically opposed to spanking. I think it is often overdone as a cheap way to punish, as a way that doesn't cost the parent anything. And I think that's inappropriate. I'm not philosophically, like most therapists are, philosophically opposed to spanking. I'm not. I think it has a time and place when you're dealing with a child that is essentially more like a puppy than a human, and they need literally their brain development, and they need an immediate consequence that is instantaneous, that doesn't have to be deeply philosophical, doesn't have to be explained. They know I can either be hurt in a way that the parent can't control, or I can be hurt a little bit in a way that the parent can control. And so, and almost never do things like spankings need to actually hurt. That's not their, it's just a surprise type of. Anyway, that's a whole other conversation, but I think there's a time and place for that. Again, I do think it gets overused sometimes, but I think for disciplining, you start disciplining immediately. You're honing the child. You intentionally leave things that they're not. You don't child-proof your house. You make sure your child isn't going to die easily in your house, but you don't child-proof as in there are things that the child could break. You want to house-proof your child, so to speak, but you don't want to child-proof your house. It's okay if the child breaks something. It's just something. But if it's a discipline opportunity for Mark Hampton, who was a quick learner, man, you talk about an easy kid, make you think you're a great parent. He was just a quick adapter. You were talking about your firstborn is not a quick adapter. And so that's all the strong-willed or weak or stronger-willed kids or more compliant kids. It's just how well they adapt. Some kids learn rules quickly. It's like, oh, that's a no. And they'll never touch it again. And if you parent well, they make you look good. By the way, if you don't parent that child well, they still turn into a brat. But if you parent that child well, they make you think you're good at it. And then some children aren't that way. They are, I got to touch it again and 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 touch it again. And those of you who are helping us raise Michael, I mean, that's Michael with almost no impulse control, whatever issues that he deals with inside that poor kid's head. He is not a quick adapter. Some of the you guys who work in the children's area are like, oh, yeah. No, we don't run down to the lake. No, we don't run down to the lake. No, we don't run down to the lake. Am I not supposed to run down to the lake? Oh, my gosh. Yes. Still not running down to the lake. Anyway, that's a constant for that kid. Well, you just have to keep doing it. Eventually, even their brain goes, oh, that's a boundary. That's why you want to make it small. You don't want to fight big boundaries. You want the child to learn this is normative before they're a teenager and can fight back, so to speak. Isn't it amazing how few 14 or 15-year-old boys realize they can beat up their mom? How few of them realize they can take their dad? Why is that? Well, because they've known from the time they were little that they couldn't. And so in a normal family system, they grow up with this respect for these parents. Even though they get to that age when it could be like, hey, son, you need to be home by 9. And he goes, you know what? I think I want to be home at 1. And there's not a stinking thing you can do about it because I'm bigger and stronger than you are. By the way, it does happen. Especially single-parent homes face that sometimes. But in that while, it's because we've taught them. This is the way the world works. These are the boundaries. And they've learned them well enough to stick with it. Anyway, there's some great questions, guys. It's about 8, so we need to be done. But, man, that was great. Do not hesitate. Josh, what's your email address?
It's josh@burgercounseling.com.
So josh@burger, B-E-R-G-E-R.
Right.
Burgercounseling.com. Yours is?
The website or address?
The address. Email address, if you don't mind.
Not at all. It's aacooper99@gmail.com. I think we both had cards if anybody wants
to. Yes, they've got cards here, and y'all can find me here anytime. Don't hesitate to email us and ask us any questions about anything. We are more interested in having a positive impact on the community. If you need something from us, we'd love to help with that. If you need someone to come teach something at your school, all of us do that. If you need to come teach something at your MOPS, we all do that, or whatever. And whatever these things are, at your business, consulting, that kind of stuff, we all do that. And you can look up any more detail than that at Alethia, A-L-E-T-H-I-A, alethiacounseling.com. Last thing, yes, sir? Where can we find the audio for this? The audio for this would probably be on our church website within the next week. That'd be my guess. Typically, it's up in about a week, and it'll say parenting seminar and with the date on it. So you should be able to find that. I'm sure we will link to it on our website at the Counseling Center, and I'll link to it on Facebook and that kind of stuff, too. But man, we want to be here for you. And now taking off that hat. So I'd love to, and we'll pray and close out. But man, a big part of this is there's not a lot of professionals who I know well enough to trust to turn the mic over to them, to you guys. And so it's awesome to me. I cannot even begin to tell you, Jonathan Ridenour, who's he's a psychologist here in town as well. I can't promise you he would back me on this. When you have some people who you can trust enough to refer to counsel people, it's like, it's just hugely freeing. I mean, part of why I started bringing on people at Alethia was because I wanted to have people who I could trust to say, you know who you need to go talk to is Millie Tanner, because she's better at the issues you're dealing with than I am. This isn't the B team. They're better at this stuff than I am. Josh is better at working with some of these young men, especially than anyone else in the area. When Ellie and our family were dealing with anxiety issues with Ellie, we went to Allison because she's the best. And so I would tell you guys, I love for you guys to know about that. So as a pastor, even if these weren't therapists who worked with me, I would tell you, make use of these resources. So very real world stuff. So I'd love to close out our time, if that's cool. And then I know that we've We've already gone till 8, which means they've had some of our kids for a long time, which is already, you know. So get over there. Be very, very thankful to everyone who's had our kids, please. And we'll wrap up now. We're about 5 minutes late, but we need to get on over there pretty quickly. If you don't have kids, to help do chairs, is that good? But if you've got kids, go get them. That's priority number one. If you don't have kids, we'd love for your help getting chairs and tables up. Let's pray. Father, thank you that this is a church that wants to do stuff like this. Thank you that we have a leader of our children's ministry like Rebecca, who stays on top of stuff like this. When are we going to do a parenting seminar? When are we going to do a parenting seminar? This is a vital thing. We want, Lord, we would ask through the power of your spirit that you would help us equip these moms and dads, or future moms and dads, or grandmoms and granddads, that they would be able to have a huge impact in raising up the children in the way that they are bent. And so that when they come to know you and they will stay on that path, I pray a blessing over our children right now, all of them, that they will love you more than they love anything else. And that they would follow us to the degree we follow your son. And I pray that our children will outgrow us in their faith, that they will be leaders in ministry in ways that we would never even dream of. Father, I pray that you would impact and change the world through our kids. I pray, Lord, that we would be excellent examples of you, knowing that we answer to you for that. That I believe we will each, every single one of us who have kids, get to speak to you someday about how well we represented you. And I want, Lord, I pray for these parents, all of us, that what we would hear from you is, well done. None of us are going to be perfect, and you know that, and you rescue us from that. Your grace is sufficient, but Lord, I pray that we would hear a well done from you as parents. I cannot even fathom what our children are going to face in this nation over the next couple generations, but they're going to have to lead our country and our churches through it. So I pray, Lord, that our church would be a place where children are prepared to face the challenges of the cultures to come here, and that they would then spread around the world here and to the uttermost parts of the world, having an impact for your kingdom. And I ask all of this in the name of your magnificent son. I pray special protection on our children, not that they wouldn't suffer, but that they wouldn't suffer anything that would cripple their ability to experience the abundant life your son has for them. I pray you would protect them from predators and abusers. I pray that your will would be done in their lives most of all. And ask this in your son's name. Amen.